Most of us have witnessed a night of drinking gone wrong. People get sloppy or maudlin or even violent. But perhaps you've also known the pleasures of a night of drinking gone right. Just the right amount of euphoria and loss of inhibition that bonds you to old friends or helps you connect with new ones. Given those examples, it can be hard to know whether our love of intoxicants is a blessing, a curse, or just some kind of evolutionary accident. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest studies human evolution, cognition, and culture, and he thinks that given the well-documented hazards of alcohol consumption, there must be some good reason the processes of natural selection have kept most human bodies equipped to process booze and kept many brains craving a slightly altered reality. Edward Slingerland is Distinguished University Scholar and Professor of Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia with adjunct appointments in psychology and philosophy and director of the Database of Religious History. His book is called Drunk: How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization. Edward, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So at the center of this book is this question of whether our love for alcohol, which indeed has some very serious drawbacks, is linked to an evolutionary hijack or, no pun intended, an evolutionary hangover. What do those two terms mean?
Yeah, so they're both versions of an evolutionary mistake theory. So the hijack theory is that alcohol and other chemical intoxicants just happen to basically pick a lock in our brains. So they just happen to hijack reward circuits that evolve for other reasons and give us pleasure for really no good reason from an evolutionary perspective. So, and that's really far and away the most common theory. If you read a standard intro psych textbook about intoxicants, that's probably what you're gonna hear, is that this is a mistake, it's a hijack. There are also some what I call hangover theories, pun intended, you could also call them mismatch theories, where our taste for alcohol was adaptive at one point in our evolutionary history. So it may have led us to the smell of alcohol, may have led us to ripe or overripe fruit. And so people who were attracted, our ancestors who were attracted to that managed to get this big calorie package as a reward. Some people hypothesize that maybe once we started settling down in large-scale communities, we had this problem of water quality. So people have typically not been that great about managing their sewage, and so people start settling down by a river, water becomes contaminated. If you take contaminated water and you ferment it, if you brew it, if you turn it into something, it actually becomes potable. It gets purified. So that's another type of theory. So these theories are all claiming there may have been some function in our evolutionary history, but that function is in the past, and actually it's been maladaptive, for the last few thousand years at least.
And the reason that maladaptive changes can hang around is that natural selection is not necessarily going for ideal, right? It will make do with good enough.
Right. So that's another hijack example is masturbation. That's what I start the book with. Evolution gives us this amazing reward for doing the thing that's most centrally related to what it wants us to do, which is pass on copies of our genes to the next generation. So it reserves the best thing that could happen to a human being, the orgasm, for the thing that's statistically, historically, been associated with passing on your genes. Now, it doesn't work perfectly, right? So humans and even other species have been gaming the system for a long time and getting rewards for things we really shouldn't be doing from evolution's perspective. But you're right, it doesn't. Evolution's is happy with good enough. And this system, despite all the non-reproductive sexual hijinks that we get up to, it's worked well enough for us to be here talking about it. So that's an example of something that's not very costly. It's a mistake, but evolution can tolerate it or wink at it because the costs aren't too high and it basically gets the job done.
You say in the book that we are animals built to get high, but why would our bodies have developed the ability to metabolize alcohol if its production in significant quantities required the invention of a technology?
Yeah, so we have naturally occurring alcohol. So I think the dominant theory about why we and other species can metabolize alcohol is because we started eating fruit. So humans and some bird species and some other primate species who feed on fruit have had to deal with alcohol. So you have fruit that falls on the forest floor or even is just ripe. It's going to have some small amount of alcohol, of ethanol. So we're talking about the ethanol molecule here. And so it's going to be adaptive. If you want to be able to use that food source, you have to be able to process this poison. So alcohol is a poison, and our body recognizes it as such. And so we have this machinery to break it down and get it out of the body as quickly as possible. So in small quantities, we've been having to deal with alcohol for probably, it looks like 10 million years. So you first see this ADH enzyme, which is the first stage of breaking down alcohol, seems to be about 10 million years old in our primate lineage.
How can we know that?
Based on molecular clocks of, you can kind of figure out when something happened by looking at changes, differences in species, and calculating, estimating what the mutation rate might be. You can kind of get a sense of when this might have happened in our evolutionary history. So clearly, we've been dealing with small quantities of alcohol for a long time. But as you say, this really changes about probably 9,000 years ago, maybe as long as 12,000 years ago, we start having to deal with large quantities of alcohol. So people figure out how to make beer and wine and get really properly drunk. And that's when we're essentially overwhelming our naturally occurring ADH enzymes and overloading our bodies and brains with ethanol, and to the point that it's causing impairment of cognition. And the real mystery is why evolution has tolerated this for so long.
So, contrary to what a lot of us were taught in school about bread and bread-like foods driving the agricultural revolution, there is growing evidence that lots of societies got serious about farming so they could have beer.
Yeah, so this is similar to the evolutionary mistake story. We've also been told that alcohol is a kind of accidental byproduct of agriculture. So we start agriculture in order to get bread and grain products. And then sometime after that, we discover someone leaves their sourdough starter out for too long and it turns into a mild beer. And we're like, oh, that's interesting. And so sometime after that, we by accident discovered alcohol. In the 1950s or so, archaeologists started to challenge this view because it became clear that we were gathering in large groups and brewing beers and making wines and having these kind of ecstatic festivals long before we had agriculture. So we were doing this before we were settled down growing grains. And so this is the so-called beer before bread theory. That argues that, in fact, the motivation for settling down and creating agriculture was to get drunk or get high. And so, in fact, it's actually the opposite. It's the other way around. We actually created, in a way, created civilization because of our craving for intoxicants. And the argument is this is true not just for beer and bread, but other parts of the world. In South America, where maize became cultivated, the wild ancestor of maize, the thing that maize was made out of, is teosinte. And it actually makes pretty bad grain products. Like, if your goal is to make a tortilla, you're going to overlook this plant because it makes terrible tortillas. What it does really well is make a good beer. So they make an alcoholic beverage called chicha out of teosinte. And that's probably why people started paying attention to this plant and then cultivating it and trying to make it more productive. So again, around the world, you see it seems to be the case that people are settling down and starting to get serious about improving plants and growing them in an organized fashion in order to make intoxicants.
How recognizable would ancient beers be to us today if we walked into some hipster bar somewhere and those were on the menu?
We'd recognize them as beer. They probably were not very good. Probably not very good beers. One of the actual earliest direct evidence, we have lots of indirect evidence of alcohol production. The earliest direct evidence comes from ancient China, so about 7,000 years ago in the Yellow River Valley. These a piece of pottery was tested that had some residue on it. And it's very cool work by this this archaeologist named Govern, who works a lot on the beginnings of fermentation, the technology of fermentation. And it's pretty clear they were making kind of wine or ale out of wild fruit and honey and some other ingredients all kind of mixed together. It probably, from a modern perspective, didn't taste very good, but you would recognize it if you walked up to a campfire and people were sitting around drinking this and they offered you some, you would know what was going on. It would certainly have the intended effect on your mind.
Like prison wine.
Yeah, it's like prison wine. It's like the wine. So this is, you know, part of the puzzle I'm trying to explain is why the greatest focus of human ingenuity in history has been this problem of how to get drunk, right? So people create these disgusting wines in prison. When people show up in a new place, when they're settling a new place, they immediately try to figure out what they can ferment in the local environment. When governments try to impose prohibition, which governments have been trying to do for at least 4,000 or 5,000 years. As long as we've had alcohol, we've been trying to ban alcohol. And when governments try to do this, people make alcohol at home. You know, they make it underground and they make it out of some really gross stuff. But it's all to the purpose of getting themselves altered in some way.
Edward, I think a lot of us know, even if we haven't thought about it in these terms, that alcohol starts as a stimulant and later sort of turns into a depressant. Nobody's at their best at the end of a long night of drinking. Yeah. Why do we not stop at that moment when we've reached the apex of how it's going to make us feel?
Yeah, well, the depressant functions are crucial as well for the social functions that I'm arguing for. So I'm arguing that the individual and social functions that alcohol has served include ramping up our creativity. So it helps to allow us to more easily think laterally or kind of think outside the box. It increases our trustingness of other people. It makes it harder for us to lie and actually makes it easier for us to detect lies. So it's important socially in terms of getting us to get past cooperation problems that we face. And it reduces stress and relaxes us in various ways. So the depressant functions are just as important as the stimulation functions.
What is the Balmer curve?
I gave a talk years ago at a Google campus, and I was talking about the relationship. My previous book was called Trying Not to Try, and it was about the relationship between spontaneity and creativity and success, charisma. And I put up a slide that was reporting the results of this study that was done that showed that if you can artificially induce spontaneity by getting people drunk, you can downregulate their prefrontal cortex. They do better at lateral thinking tasks, so situations where you need to connect otherwise unconnected things. And it was just kind of a throwaway comment in my talk, but the first person, his arm shot up at the beginning of the Q&A period. He said, "Hey, have you ever heard of the Balmer peak?" And I hadn't. And it, supposedly, this is almost certainly apocryphal, but supposedly Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, determined experimentally that there was a perfect point where you're coding your coding abilities were at their peak, and it was this very narrow blood alcohol content. And supposedly he would get just to that point and then keep himself on essentially a vodka IV drip to stay right at that peak. And so they told me about this, which is a great idea. And then after the talk, they took me on a tour of the campus. And the first place they took me, they said, "You have to see this." They took me to their whiskey room. And this was this room where when they were running into problems, they couldn't figure out, they were slamming their head against the wall. Instead of continuing to do that, they would take a break. They would go to this whiskey room, and they would have foosball table and beanbag chairs, and they would drink a little bit of scotch and they would talk about it. And often in the course of doing that, a solution would present itself. So that was actually when this book project crystallized for me because I realized, hey, you know, people are using alcohol in an instrumental way. They're using it in a very deliberate way. And Google's a pretty successful organization. So it may be the case that successful cultures and organizations have figured out a way to use alcohol as a tool.
So this disinhibition effect can help alcohol make us feel bonded to close friends, but it can also sort of bond us to strangers in a crowd or a bar somewhere. Why would something like that, that ability to suddenly trust and get along with people we don't know, be an evolutionary advantage?
Because when we start living in large-scale societies, we're having to cooperate on a scale that we're just not designed for. Mm. We're a weird primate. So, you know, we're primates, and our ancestors and our primate cousins all live in pretty small groups where they're cooperating primarily with relatives or at least people they know. When we make this transition to agriculture, we're suddenly having to live in these large anonymous societies where we're cooperating with strangers all the time. And we need to feel bonded to them. We need to feel some sense of identity with them. And what I'm arguing is religion is one of the tools that cultures use to get people to create fake families, right? You create a sense of fictive kinship with others. That's one tool that cultures use. Another is alcohol. So being able to feel bonded to strangers is important if you're going to get these strangers to cooperate effectively.
Okay, so the great ancient societies of the world often were marked by these mega structures that they would create near where they lived. What role might alcohol have played in compelling people to work on colosseums and pyramids and temples?
Yeah, it's the big reward people would get. So it's in pre-modern societies, almost the only way to get a large public project done is by offering people, I mean, you offer food, but you're also offering intoxicants. And so one of this early site I talk about in what's now Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, it's probably 10, 12,000 years old. And it's puzzling because it's got these enormous stone pillars that were cut out and dragged some distance and then erected and carved. And this was all done by hunter-gatherers. So people who were otherwise just wandering around hunting and gathering would gather at this place and engage in really backbreaking labor. We also discover at this site massive basins where some sort of beverage was prepared. And we don't have direct residue evidence that this was alcohol, but it almost certainly was. And so cultures are using alcohol as both a tool to bind people together and get them to cooperate, but also as a reward for working on these kind of large-scale cooperative projects.
On a much smaller scale, people will be familiar with the way alcohol puts some in the mood for sex. Could that be an evolutionary advantage that cultures that, you know, were likely to use alcohol had more kids on balance than ones who didn't?
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. It's certainly by lowering inhibitions, it maybe makes you more likely to engage in sex. It has a paradoxical effect. It increases libido. So when you drink, people have higher libidos. They're more interested in sex. And in experiments, they're more likely to look longer at sexualized materials. They feel themselves to be more attractive, and they find others to be more attractive. So beer goggles is not just a myth, it's actually experimentally been verified. So it's definitely possible that this has historically been one of the functions of alcohol. But this is also where you get into I spent a whole chapter talking about the dangers of alcohol. And this is one area where alcohol can also have these really dark undersides.
Yeah, I mean, it's often part of the story when we hear about the kinds of sexual assaults that take place, you know, in college campuses, for example. Is it reasonable to blame drinking for sexual assault?
The motive to sexually assault someone is not produced by alcohol. Alcohol is just reducing the inhibition to doing so. So if you want to blame something, you would blame patriarchal views or a kind of culture that undervalues women or has strange views about sex. So I don't think it's directly responsible in that regard. But alcohol has become a lot more dangerous recently than it historically has been. So for most of our history, we've been drinking basically like kind of 2-3% alcohol by volume beers. It's really hard to get overly pass out drunk drinking a beer like that. It's impossible to kill yourself. You're going to tend to just get mildly inebriated, which is where most of the benefits seem to happen. When things start to go awry is I talk about these two dangers of modernity when it comes to alcohol. And the first is distillation. So at a certain point, we figured, and quite recently, actually, probably just a few hundred years ago, we figured out how to get around natural limits on alcohol by volume by distilling, taking relatively weak wines and beers and turning them into vodka, you know, something that's got like 90% ABV. These distilled liquors really should be considered an entirely different drug. They're still ethanol, but they're just so much more powerful. And we don't seem to be biologically equipped to deal with distilled alcohol. The other problem is what I call isolation. So we're drinking at home alone. We're drinking in environments that are not subject to traditional types of ritual safeguards against excessive drinking. So if you look at something like a college frat party, that's like the nightmare scenario from a cultural evolutionary perspective. You got all these kids who already don't have PFCs. So the PFC is the last thing to mature. Right. It doesn't mature until your 20s, mid-20s. So they're already lacking PFCs. They then are drinking distilled liquors in a completely weird environment without any supervision from grown-ups. And that just is a recipe for disaster. So I think the darker, we're seeing more of the darker side of alcohol because some of the traditional safeguards on alcohol consumption have been removed.
How did people figure out how to distill spirits, and why did it take off like gangbusters once that happened?
It's an easy concept. So Aristotle talked about the principles of it. So you basically, ethanol is a very volatile molecule. So it boils at a lower heat point than water does. So you take your beer, you boil it, and the ethanol comes off first. And if you can figure out a way to capture that vapor and turn it back into a liquid, you've got pretty much pure ethanol. You can't get 100%, but you can get pretty close. The problem is that even though conceptually it's simple, it's technologically really difficult to do. You have to have mastered metallurgy or glass working. You need to be able to keep things under pressure, which is, so, you know, in the Prohibition, when people started building home stills to make their own distilled liquor, they often exploded. It's actually really dangerous. You got hot liquids under pressure. It's not a good, it's like the Prohibition equivalent of meth labs in modern America. So it took a long time to master. But once we did, we had this substance that gave us this incredible jolt of pleasure when we consumed it. Distilled liquors are easy to transport. They don't spoil very well. And so they tended to be taken to the New World when Europeans went to the New World. So it's appealing to primates who evolved to drink, you know, low strength beers and wine. This is really stimulating that pleasure center in our brain. But then that's part of the problem.
What do we know about the role that culture plays in the rate at which people develop alcohol abuse disorders or alcoholism? Why, for example, is the percentage of alcoholics in Russia greater than the percentage of alcoholics in Italy?
Because different cultures have different ways of managing alcohol use. And so it's probably the case that about 15% of the human population is genetically prone to alcoholism. There's a strong genetic component to alcoholism. And yet, as you say, we see these really different rates in different parts of the world. In cultures like Italy and other, what anthropologists sometimes refer to as southern drinking cultures. So they're talking about Europe here, southern Europe. So Italy, Spain, Portugal, is alcohol is part of everyday life. So they focus on wine and beer. You only drink at the dinner table or the lunch table. You only drink with meals. You only drink with other people at meals. It's a normal part of everyday life. You introduce children at an early age to alcohol, so small amounts in Italy. So my ex-wife's half Italian, and we spent a lot of time in Italy. And my daughter grew up experiencing this culture. And, you know, kids get a little bit of wine at a meal, you know, heavily watered down, and then you make it less watered down as they get older. And so kids come to learn that alcohol is just a normal part of life. Drinking to get drunk is frowned upon. So public drunkenness is considered kind of shameful and a sign that you're immature and you're not really a proper adult. So these are all cultural ways to tame Dionysus, if you want to think of it that way. We need these functional benefits that alcohol provides, but it's a very Dionysus has a dark side. And so we need to figure out how to use alcohol without abusing it. And it does seem that these Southern European cultures have figured out how to do that, as opposed to what's called Northern cultures, which tend to binge drink. They tend to drink more hard liquors. They tend to, drinking to get drunk is acceptable and even considered maybe manly or a sign that you're kind of heroic. And that's the kind of culture you see in Russia. And that's probably why alcoholism rates are so much higher there.
So your earlier points, Edward, about the social cohesion and trust and creativity that can be brought on by moderate alcohol use are well taken. But I wonder what your response is to members of communities like the LDS Church that have long forbidden any kind of intoxicants, alcohol in particular, among their members and have really thrived.
Yeah, so one of the puzzles, so we have this genetic solution to the quote-unquote problem of alcohol that never really took off. It remains in this small part of East Asia. You also have cultural solutions to the problem. So the cultural solution is banning alcohol. And there are cultural groups. So people have been trying to ban alcohol again for as long as we've had alcohol. So some of the earliest legal codes from ancient China include penalties of death for anyone caught drinking. So they were trying, and they weren't very successful. The Chinese kept drinking. You have Islam. So Islam at a certain point forbids alcohol, and that may have been a feature. And Islam has been a relatively successful religion. So you can see cultural groups benefiting from banning alcohol. The mystery, though, is why, in the same way it's mysterious why the Asian flushing gene hasn't spread throughout the entire human population, it's mysterious why cultural groups that ban alcohol haven't taken over the world. And so there's an encounter I talk about in the book from the 700s, where this Muslim ambassador is going to what's now Russia, the Volga River, and encounters the Vikings. And he describes them. He's very impressed by their height and their fierceness, but he's disgusted by their use of alcohol. They get falling down drunk every night. He witnesses a fight where someone kills the other person in a drunken rage. And he comes from a culture that at the time was banning alcohol. So you have this cultural encounter, 700s. Why didn't that group that was banning alcohol eventually wipe out the Vikings and take over all of Europe? Because we know that he's correct. Viking culture was heavily dependent on alcohol. They really used it arguably to excess. And yet, if you're gonna nominate some successful cultural groups from history, the Vikings would be up there. You know, a lot of the residents of modern Northern Europe are descendants of them. So it's, and then the question is, you know, if you look at the LDS Church, they're banning all intoxicants, they're banning all psychoactive substances. So not just intoxicants, but also nicotine and caffeine. And this makes you start to think that the target of this prohibition is not really intoxication per se. It's a signaling device, because nicotine and caffeine from an evolutionary perspective are great. They just help us do what we want to do in our daily lives more efficiently. So this suggests that the ban for the LDS Church is really more about what in the cognitive science of religion we'd call costly signaling. It's a way to signal to your fellow members that you're really a serious part of the church. And it's a way to impress outsiders with what a cohesive group we are. So it's not really about the intoxicants per se. It's a kind of signal, a cultural signal.
You call yourself a philosophical hedonist. What does that mean in practice?
Practice. So the Hedonist as a modern English word tends to have connotations of just being, you know, into drugs and sex and eating, gluttony. It's not what hedonism originally meant. So the ancient Greek hedonists, that's where our word comes from, were actually not that fun. You wouldn't want to invite them to a party. Hedonism as a philosophy is arguing is that the purpose of life is pleasure. So why do we exist? What are we in the world for? It's to experience pleasure. But for these ancient Greek hedonists, they thought the highest pleasures were philosophy and math and thinking about big topics. And they actually thought that things like alcohol and food and even sex were fleeting pleasures, and so actually not really properly pleasures at all. And so as a philosophical hedonist, I'm kind of in between the modern sense and the ancient Greeks. I think that physical pleasures have a role to play in our lives, an important role to play. And this comes up in the context of at the end of the book. So I've made an evolutionary argument for why we drink. And it's because drinking plays these functional roles and it's been adaptive at both the individual and the cultural level in various ways. But then finally, you want to add on top of that, it makes us feel good. And pleasure, evolution doesn't care about pleasure. So that can't be part of the evolutionary argument. Evolution doesn't care if we're happy or not. But we care whether we're happy or not. We're not our genes. And so on top of all the functional benefits, there's this immense pleasure that comes from drinking, that comes from boosting our endorphin levels and relaxing and taking a break from hypervigilant consciousness. And so that's got to be, pleasure has to be counted in the plus side of things when we're thinking about whether or not we're going to use alcohol or how we're going to use alcohol.
Edward Slingerland is Distinguished University Scholar and Professor of Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia with adjunct appointments in psychology and philosophy, and he's co-director of the Center for the Study of Human Evolution, Cognition, and Culture, and director of the Database of Religious History. His book is called Drunk: How We Sipped, Danced, and Stumbled Our Way to Civilization. Edward, this has been really interesting. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.